Tensions in Asia accelerated this week after the Russian Federation Navy seized a Chinese merchant vessel, only to have it sunk out from under them by a submarine of the Chinese People's Liberation Navy. Russian naval forces were in the process of transporting a ship to Vladivostok, claiming a routine inspection revealed the ship's crew had succumbed to the reanimating virus. Chinese officials ended their silence on the matter, saying they could not allow the Russian government to bear the burden of decontaminating another ship. All this comes as tensions mount along the border between China and Russia. RLA's Michael Greenspan will bring us the latest from the State Department. Scientists at a research center in Montana announced they have discovered evidence in the fossil record that the RADM1 virus is actually millions of years old and may have existed in the Cretaceous period. They released their findings earlier this week, suggesting not just that the virus existed in the age of the dinosaurs, but that it may have actually been the extinction event that ended their reign on Earth. We'll bring you all the details. While citizens all over living America make sacrifices and compromise, members of one family in Rhode Island have taken each other to court, saying that during the crisis, they have reached an impossible impasse over the distribution of the family's many vacation homes, claiming that fuel restrictions have made access difficult to two of the clan's four seaside houses. They have decided adjudication is the only option. Laura Sanders is in Rhode Island and will report on this strange and disappointing story. Miami Mayor Santiago Vasquez announced this week that he will be running for President of the United States in next year's election. And in an unconventional move, concurrently announced that Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, William Abibio, will be his running mate. We'll be joined by both men at this week's RLA discussion table. We'll talk about the chemistry of their ticket, strategies behind defeating the reanimated, and their proposition to the American people. You're listening to Radio Living America, and I'm Chuck Fleming, in for Brian Andrews. Our first story begins in Washington, D.C., where State Department officials are attempting to defuse the evolving crisis between China and Russia. Chinese officials claim it is not just their right, but their responsibility to sink a Chinese vessel that the Russian Navy reported was contaminated. But Russian authorities say they had the situation in control and that a live-fire submarine attack such as this put Russian naval assets and personnel at risk. This comes as the two sides blamed each other for an aircraft accident along the Russia-China border that resulted in the loss of six Russian Air Force crewmen and one Chinese pilot. RLA's Michael Greenspan reports from the nation's capital.
State Department officials here at the Harry S. Truman Building have been working tirelessly this week, trying to analyze the developments of the last 7 days and what it could mean for stability and ultimately trade in the region. We are being told that the timeline started a week ago today, when the Russian frigate Rostov on Don encountered the Chinese merchant vessel Zheng He, which was en route to Shanghai. The Russians claim that the Zheng He, which was outbound from Vancouver with a cargo of grain, was not under command and showed signs of being an infected ship, forcing them to perform an assault on the vessel and take control. The Chinese are claiming that they should be the ones who deal with the infected ships of the People's Navy, and for that reason they deployed a submarine to sink the Zheng He. Secretary of State Tillman addressed the press pool today.
It benefits no country in the world for tensions to escalate on the border between Russia and China. The pandemic war will yield enough war stories and enough war heroes and enough war dead to last 100 lifetimes, 1,000 lifetimes. We don't need more war. It's my deepest wish that the United States can help resolve this amicably. We are in constant communication with the representatives from China, and we are in contact with Russian officials. The United States cannot work magic, but we can try to increase exports, potentially even to Russia, in spite of the ban of 2024.
But one only had to listen to the statement by Ambassador Lei Wenzhang in Washington to understand the gravity of the situation.
The People's Republic does not have the capability to express the level of gratitude that is owed to the Russian Republic and its proud navy. We look forward to returning the generosity. How could a nation such as China possibly survive without them sparing us from so much pandemic threat. This is why the People's Republic felt compelled to have one of our submarines sink the Zhenghe. The Russian Republic has suffered enough at the hands of our commerce with the West.
And we promise they will be inconvenienced no more. The problem is that this doesn't happen in a vacuum. Earlier this week, two aircraft of the Chinese and Russian air forces collided along their shared border northeast of North Korea, with both air crews being lost. Admiral William McCall, who was recently promoted to head of naval operations, addressed reporters at the Pentagon yesterday.
We are operating in an environment of limited information. But what I can tell you is that even with the pandemic, we try to maintain assets where we can. To that end, the USS Ashland, LSD-48, was on the patrol it began 16 months ago in the Sea of Japan. Earlier this week, radio operators on the Ashland intercepted what they believe was radio traffic between a Chinese Sukhoi 27 intercept fighter and a Russian Tupolev 95 reconnaissance aircraft that were operating along the Russia-China border just north of North Korea.
Captain, we have radar contact bearing 075 degrees. Angel 3-1, range 7 miles.
What do you think, Misha?
He's closing fast, Captain. Has to be Chinese interceptor, probably Sukhoi 27 or MiG-31.
Hey, Ivan, what are you doing so close to PRC airspace? You better stay on your side of the border, unless you want to defect, of course.
Why don't you make me, you little rat? My uncle was Soviet Spetsnaz at Demansky in 1969.
Demansky in 69? How old are you, Ivan?
Come over here and find out, you piece of shit.
If you insist, comrade.
He's right on top of us, Captain.
Namir Chetia. Sandlodge. Namir Chetia. Sandlodge.
Captain, we have a compressor stall in outboard number 4.
Back off, you asshole. We're dropping an engine over here.
Exhaust gas temperature is out of limit, Captain.
Namir OD. Sandlodge. Namir OD. Sandlodge.
Decrease throttle on number 4 and number 1 to 20%. Help me level the nose, Misha.
We believe the two aircraft collided with the loss of all crew members. The Ashland has been recalled from patrol as the area has been deemed too hostile and supporting naval assets cannot be deployed at this time. However, as she was leaving the Sea of Japan, the Ashland observed a sharp increase in aircraft radio traffic along the part of the border where the collision occurred.
Now, the Admiral talked about withdrawing from the region, but U.S. Navy High Command is also coordinating with Canadian naval authorities. Vice Admiral Hugh H.C. McDonough of the Royal Canadian Navy spoke to Canadian TV today.
We are in constant communication with our trade partners in China, as well as our security partners in the United States. The Canadian Navy cannot secure safe passage across the Northern Pacific Ocean. However, given the current events, we are deploying Canadian naval vessels, and we believe we can send ships south from Vancouver, where they can assemble with American ships bound for Asia via the southern trade routes and establish an adequately secure convoy system.
While all parties involved pretend to put on a patina of peace, the drums of war, even in this pandemic crisis, are hard to ignore. From the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., I'm Michael Greenspan.
The Cretaceous period may have ended 65 million years ago, but the legacy of that time may live on today in more than just fossils. Scientists this week are proclaiming that the RADM virus may have existed in prehistoric times and even been the agent that caused the collapse of the dinosaur age. For more, we go to RLA's Miles Duggan.
I'm here at the Rocky Mountain Museum of Natural Science with Dr. Sarah Engel, professor at the University of Montana, who claims to have not just mapped the dinosaur genome, but claims to have uncovered evidence of the RADM virus in the fossil record. We had a chance to sit down with Dr. Engel earlier today. Doctor, explain to us what you found and why it's important.
Well, if you're a paleontologist, there's a handful of holy grails. One is finding a female Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I did that in 2000. I felt like I was at the top of my career on my first big fossil find. I didn't realize I was just at the beginning, because it was in that first female tyrannosaur where I found soft tissue.
Why is it important that you found soft tissue?
Soft tissue is where all the genetic information is. Hard fossils tell us nothing outside of the form factor the fossilized organism represented. But to really understand dinosaurs and the world they lived in, you need DNA. And now that we know what to look for, we've been extracting it for nearly 30 years.
And what's the good news?
I wish I had good news. Virus is a fragile thing. And because of this, there is no example of it in the fossil record. But we can track virus, well, sort of, by what impact virus has on its host DNA. You see, virus can't replicate on its own. It needs to hijack the host cellular mechanism to reproduce. And in that process, it leaves a sort of impression, a fingerprint, if you will, on its host DNA.
Are you talking about in the fossil record, or are you talking about RADM?
I'm talking about RADM in the fossil record. The last dinosaur period was the Cretaceous, and it existed between 145 million and 65 million years ago. You have to remember, extracting fossil DNA is a risky business. We have to dissolve the fossil in acid in the hopes of finding soft tissue, and whether we do or we don't, the fossil is destroyed. When we look at dinosaur DNA from the early Cretaceous, what little we have, we see no evidence of the virus. Then, we look at middle Cretaceous. We would expect to see some evidence of RADM if it were some slow-moving disease that ended in herd immunity, but we don't. Then, we get to the fossils of the later Cretaceous, and every single fossil shows evidence of RADM. And that's where the fossil record stops.
So are you suggesting this caused the dinosaurs to go extinct?
There isn't nearly enough data to make any conclusions. Remember, we only get genetic material from a very small number of fossils that we collect. However, where we can do that kind of analysis, we see this disease showing up towards the end of the dinosaur age. And it looks like it moved quickly through the population. It's actually causing us to look at all our fossils from the late Cretaceous differently, whether we can extract DNA or not.
How so?
Well, you see violent trauma in the fossils up and down the entire Mesozoic age, and it makes sense. You would expect to see herbivores that bore the evidence of a carnivorous predator attack. But at the end of the dinosaur age, we suddenly see this huge spike in bone traumas that look more like, say, a strict plant eater like a Parasaurolophus attacking another Parasaurolophus, or a Tyrannosaurus attacking another Tyrannosaurus.
So are you saying the dinosaurs had reanimated and were trying to consume one another?
For years, we attributed these fossil injuries to some kind of mating competition or a territorial dispute within a species of animal. But now, who knows? Look, our only evidence is in bones that are tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of years old. The only thing I can tell you with certainty is that about 65 million years ago, it all suddenly stopped.
Dr. Engel would go on to tell us that the Museum of the Rockies would allow her team access to more of their fossil collection to try DNA extraction. But for now, the mystery of what brought an end to the dinosaurs only appears to deepen.
When we return, a family in Rhode Island shows they can't get along. What we know at this time is that UN forces are surrounded just south of Mogadishu. The officer in command there, American Marine Corps Colonel Santiago Vasquez, has to worry not just about his own troops, but about the thousands of refugees pouring into his camp, trying to evade the punishment of the local Somali warlord pressing this attack. As I speak, Vasquez is fighting to maintain control of the Aden Ade International Airport, his last point of resupply.
Mayoral candidate Santiago Vasquez returned to his home neighborhood of Alapata today to talk to Miami residents about his plans to revitalize neighborhoods and create an environment of prosperity.
Despite the government's attempts, the Alapata neighborhood of Miami continues to descend into chaos. However, this hasn't stopped Miami's mayor from making his presence known in this hot spot of infection and reassuring residents that
it was just moments ago that a critical artillery mission was executed on Miami International Airport. And already, Mayor Santiago Vasquez is out of his position, pushing his forces forward. Reporting from the front in Miami, Florida, I'm Kate Malik.
We did not choose this fight, these circumstances, or this battlefield, but we will fight. We will fight for our families. We will fight for our neighbors, and we will fight for our homes. We will fight, and we won't stop fighting until we have reclaimed our city or find ourselves lying in Brickell Park, choking on our own blood. I'm Santiago Vasquez, and I approve of this message.
Across the country, Americans have shown their compassion towards one another. Some take in strangers during a community event. Others make their homes available for children whose parents were lost to the pandemic. Citizens of the United States have done their best to accommodate their fellow countrymen. But in a town in New England, one family has seen the need to take the fight to itself. Laura Sanders reports from Rhode Island.
New Dover, Rhode Island has a rich history. Originally inhabited by the Sakonnet tribe of American Indians, it would eventually be occupied by English settlers who came out of Plymouth Colony in the 17th century. As rich as the history is, the area today is defined by an even greater level of wealth, with decamillion-dollar beach compounds and exclusive country clubs, completely untouched by the reanimate threat. However, this enviable lap of luxury hasn't stopped one-storied New Dover family from taking itself to court.
All rise for the Honorable Judge Martha Maple.
Be seated. So this is a matter of the case of, let's see, am I seeing this correctly? Von Beck versus Von Beck versus Von Beck? Okay. Well, this is a new one for me. Would the plaintiff please rise?
Your Honor, I'm Reed Schoonmaker, representing attorney for the plaintiff, Chip Von Beck.
Oh, and I thought today would be a boring day. Present your case, Mr. Schoonmaker.
Your Honor, my client is suffering enormous emotional distress at the hands of his cousins, Chet Von Beck and Chick Von Beck, who are making inequitable demands on the family's properties located in New Dover.
My heart is bleeding, Counselor. What are the damages sought?
We seek no specific monetary damages, Your Honor. Rather, my client seeks an injunction that will restrict his cousins from coming on the property.
I'm just going to need a moment, Counselor, while I try to hold my breath until I die.
The three cousins, Chip Chet and Chick Von Beck, have begun a litigious family feud over an inability to share four beach houses among three families. Earlier today, we caught up with the plaintiff, Chip Von Beck, and asked him about the case. Chip, I think many people following this story scratch their heads wondering how three families who are related and have a long history together can't amicably manage four beach houses between them.
First off, it's five beach houses. But only three are in New Dover. One is on Block Island, and one is on Nantucket. And for some reason, they're only running monthly ferries there. And that doesn't work for me. My mom said I could have the houses in New Dover for the whole summer.
Well, the restricted ferry schedule is probably a byproduct of the fuel restrictions associated with the pandemic.
The what?
The reanimate pandemic. You know, it's created a national restriction on petroleum products.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know anything about that.
I see. That's interesting and disappointing.
That would explain why I can't get a net jet to J-Hole.
J-Hole?
Jackson Hole.
Oh, what would you say to those that might accuse you of insensitivity, given the national suffering that's going on right now?
I voted for Bernie Sanders in 2024.
That wasn't the question, but okay.
I only drive electric cars.
Also not the question.
Some of my old frat brothers and I are throwing a big party at the second house down in New Dover tonight. I think you should swing by.
Thank you, but no. I think, no. Since I conducted that interview, The two Von Beck cousins named in that case have filed counter-lawsuits, causing Chip Von Beck to file another lawsuit against each cousin, meaning that the new Dover docket is choked with a staggering 8 lawsuits that are titled Von Beck versus Von Beck versus Von Beck. From New Dover, Rhode Island, I'm Laura Sanders.
When we return, I'll be joined by presidential candidate Santiago Vasquez and his running mate, General William Mibibio.
Do you find yourself staring at your golden retriever and asking, what's this dog really good for? When you're feeding your King Charles Spaniel, do you think, I don't want this to be all that stands between me and a reanimate? Sure, that dachshund is cute and seemed like a good idea a couple years ago. But now, do you wish you had a furry friend that was a little more practical? I'm Patrick Coffin, and if you answered yes to any of these questions, you need to get down to Coffin's Berkshire Kennels and check out some of our security dogs bred specifically for the reanimating pandemic. Come check out our new designer breeds like a Mastiff Rhodesian Ridgeback mix, a Pitbull Doberman mix, or maybe keep it simple with a German Shepherd. With government restrictions easing on civilian ownership of certain breeds, there's never been a better time to get a weapons-grade canine. Let us set you up with a Russian Ovchaka or our new Great Dane Rottweiler combo. With flexible payment options and low APR financing, let us put you into a canine built for the pandemic era. And with every adoption, we'll even throw in a Yorker Poo or a Labradoodle of your choice.
We return to a very prominent episode of the Discussion Table, being joined by Miami Mayor and presidential candidate Santiago Vasquez and his running mate, William Ibibio, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Mayor Vasquez, congratulations on a truly inspirational victory in Miami. But with the rebuilding process just set to begin in your city, why choose now to run for president of the United States?
Our victory in Miami is exactly why I want to run for president. Since the beginning of the pandemic, this country has suffered from mismanagement and a type of selfish denial of reality that only serves to protect political careers. I want to take the lessons of Miami and apply them to the nation as a whole.
And what exactly are those lessons?
The biggest lesson is that the American people understand we need to step up and face the threat head on. Look, the current administration has employed a failed strategy of isolation. If an area becomes a problem, too bad. Let's forget it ever existed and try to pretend it won't happen again. But the American people know it will happen again. And if we don't get on our front foot and face the enemy, it will eat us alive. Literally. Town by town. City by city. County by county, until the whole country is gone.
General Ibibio, until this week's announcement, you were a senior member of the current administration. Do you agree that President Stephenson's strategy of containment is too conservative and ultimately destined to fail? And if so, why were you not a bigger proponent of more aggressive military action?
First, I completely agree with Santiago that we need to start fighting back. The great frustration I've had as part of this administration is moving this president to action. Do you think for one moment that the Galveston operation would have happened were it not for people like myself and Admiral William McCall and then Navy Ops Chief Casper Taylor screaming at the president? I can assure you it would not. And we would now be weeks away from depleting our strategic petroleum reserves, effectively leaving us with 18th century military capabilities.
But General, weren't you the one, early in the crisis, that publicly recommended the president pursue a strategy of containment? Weren't you the one that advised we should try to stabilize the pandemic front line and accept that there was too much cost to actually engaging with the enemy?
I said that at the very beginning of the crisis, at the time when we had troops deployed in heavy fighting in over half a dozen major American cities. At that time, we still weren't sure exactly how the disease spread. We had unreliable data regarding incubation times. We had no idea what the enemy's strengths and weaknesses were, and we were still months away from having an effective local defense strategy. Our understanding of the enemy is light years ahead of where we were when we pulled out of Los Angeles and Houston. To not evolve strategy, as our understanding of the battlefield evolves, would be lunacy.
to not be conscious of the need to change tactics just because I refuse to admit that the strategy I recommended at one point in time doesn't fit all points in time would be the most selfish thing I could do. It's a child's interpretation of command.
Mayor Vasquez, a real crisis is brewing between China and Russia. It started over a single cargo ship, but now seems to be a broader conflict that, at its roots, really reflects two countries buckling from a lack of resources. Some of those who still support the outgoing president have suggested that he had the right idea when he opened up to the suggestion of exporting critical resources abroad. Would you be open to such negotiations if it de-escalated the crisis?
Absolutely not. Would I be open to negotiating with Russia to lift the ban on agricultural exports? Yes, I would be willing to entertain that idea. But as long as there is still a single living stronghold that needs to be liberated in this country, we will not be exporting resources that are critical to our war-fighting capabilities.
General, you once said on this very program that providing aid internationally was in the best interest of the United States. Are you reversing that position?
Not at all. First, when I made that statement, I was referring exclusively to surplus agricultural products, not commodities that we are currently rationing or restricting here in the United States. I shook with anger when I heard President Stevenson entertain the idea of exporting refined petroleum to the European Union. Second, this conflict between China and Russia, in my view, is independent of the reanimate war. They could and should de-escalate this crisis right now.
Mr. Mayor, if the strategy of your administration is to focus all the nation's resources toward going on the offensive, would you cancel the mission to Mars?
No, I would not. And for one simple reason. The American people want it. For far too long, American politics has been about a class of political Illuminati selling an idea to America for the purpose of making the American people do the bidding of the government. I recognize that the government is there to serve the people and determine the best course of action to execute the will of the people. America is excited to go to Mars, and it's easy to understand why. And if something generates as much enthusiasm as the Artemis mission, then guess what? We're going to Mars.
General, much of our discussion has involved the idea of the United States not just responding to the reanimate threat, but actually going on the offensive. What new tactics or technologies do you envision that would allow that to be successful?
I've said it before on this program. We must start preparing to deploy a robotic presence on the battlefield. Dr. Watanabe at MIT has prototyped artificial intelligence programs that are mission-ready. And the engineers at New England Dynamics have developed the form factors for three variants of a hunter-killer infantry robot, a dirigible recharging robot equipped with solar sails, and a reconnaissance robot. On my orders, the Army sent a request for manufacturing plans to the defense contracting community 12 weeks ago, and I believe that if we move forward and fully fund this project, we could have two completely autonomous robotic divisions within 12 months.
But General, we had Dr. Watanabe on this program, and he indicated that the technology was still too volatile for deployment, and he told us some horrifying stories of the programs operating outside their intended limits. Has that changed?
Actually, I'd like to answer that question. It is not the role of the science community to set public policy. It is the role of the science community to provide the government with the best available data. It's the role of the government to aggregate the risks identified by the science community and balance it against the needs of the country. Look, I have nothing but respect for Dr. Watanabe and his work. But if the only people we listened to were scientists, we would be living in a world where all our policies were geared to the extremes. I believe with appropriate safeguards, we can deploy this technology. And there is no greater risk right now than the reanimate war. We must be aggressive. We must bring all our assets to bear. The way is forward. If I'm elected president, there will not be another step back.
Well, thank you both for being on the program, and congratulations on the announcement of your candidacy. That concludes this week's program. Brian Andrews will be returning in the next installment of Radio Living America. Until then, I'm Chuck Fleming, asking that you stay safe, stay alert, and stay in the fight.
This is a message from the emergency broadcast system. This is not a test.
Well, it's not really an emergency. It's just me again, Brian Miller, creator of Radio Living America. And I promise this is the last time. That concludes season one, and I hope you enjoyed it. I've got some great ideas for season two, but it's going to be a lot harder to move forward with this franchise if season one isn't a success. If you had fun in the world of RLA and would like to see it move to a second season, the most important thing you can do is to share this podcast with other people and give it a 5-star review on Apple. Also, be sure to check back on our Teespring page. We've got some fun merch that will be coming to the store in Q1 of 2021, and if you enjoyed storylines like Southwestern Nautilus, the Mysterious Baron Brothers, or Coffin's Berkshire Kennels, there will be some fun gear that will make it easy to show your support. As always, link in the description. Finally, please make sure to subscribe as we plan to release some bonus content that I'm sure you won't want to miss. That concludes my sign-off for season one. Until next time, I'm Brian Miller for RLA Studios, asking that you stay safe, stay alert, and let's all stay in the fight.